You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, can be won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Construction and General Laborers Local 1290 and Blake and Ulig, PA. Construction and General Laborers Local 1290 represents over 2,300 men and women in the construction industry throughout Kansas and western Missouri. Blake and Ulig, advocates for labor for over 40 years, proudly representing organized labor and its members throughout Missouri and Kansas. We thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, most labor experts predict that the U.S. Supreme Court is about to deal a death blow to America's public sector unions, causing them to go bankrupt. The case is Janus versus AFSCME. Tonight, we dedicate the entire show to the case and what unions are doing to prepare for a decision from the conservative-leaning court. Will the Janus case be mortal, or are the unions figuring out how to survive? In the news, State Senator Jake Hummel talks about the challenges for labor to repeal right to work, and Turkish garment workers put notes into customers' clothes that demand that they be paid for sewing the garment. Our feature at the end of the show is Remember Our Struggle with Arianna Eckel. Now for the news.
November 9, 2017. The St. Louis Labor Beacon reports on a speech by State Senator and Missouri AFL-CIO Secretary Treasurer Jake Hummel about the challenges unions face in winning the battle against right to work. He was at the South St. Louis Labor Club. As listeners will recall, Missouri collected three times the number of signatures needed to place a repeal of right to work on the 2018 ballot for voters to decide. Hummel said, "This is going to be a long campaign. Labor needs to educate members about the harm right to work causes, and it must do a lot of voter registration." He said surveys show only 78% of Missouri union members and only 43% of their spouses are registered to vote. The burning question is whether the right to work repeal will be on the ballot in August or November. Ballot language on the petition specifically called for November 2018 vote, but Hummel says it's possible that the legislature and governor could put the measure on the ballot in August primary rather than the November general election. He said, "We hope that doesn't happen," adding that moving the election date would be a gamble for Republican legislators. Moving the election to August would almost certainly result in a lopsided turnout by union members and RTW opponents, Hummel said. But leaving the election in November ballot would mean legislatures who are up for election will have to face many of the same voters they hurt by passing RTW. The Koch brothers have already pledged to spend millions to try to stop RTW repeal effort and have already paid for a series of deceptive mailers to Missouri voters. "We can't outspend the Koch brothers. That's fine. They've got the money, but we've got the people, and they don't." Hummel said that one way to ensure RTW is defeated at the polls is to help gather petition signatures for two other initiatives to raise Missouri's minimum wage to $12 an hour and place the Clean Missouri Ethics Reform Measure on the 2018 ballot. Getting them on the ballot, he said, will help us because the people that are hurt that are going to turn out to vote to raise the minimum wage and clean up Missouri politics are going to vote to defeat RTW.
And this comes from the, believe it or not, it's Kansas folder. Salina, Kansas City commissioners passed a resolution Monday that says city employees cannot be discriminated against because of their sexual orientation and gender identity. The vote adds those categories to the city's personnel manual. The resolution applies only to city employees. The Salina Journal reports the commission also approved a resolution adding public accommodation protections for sexual orientation and gender identity for access to city facilities and services. Natalie Fisher, the city director of human resources, said that she had received positive responses to the proposal from city employees. There is no public comment, but several people in the audience applauded for after the vote.
Daisy Buchanan, writing in The Guardian, says Zara, the UK fast fashion company, millions of consumers of their clothing should be shocked and infuriated by reports that factory workers in Istanbul have been hiding notes in the clothes that they have been producing for one of Zara's suppliers, pleading for help. One note said, "I made this item you're going to buy, but I didn't get paid for it." The workers were reportedly left unpaid after their factory shut down overnight. Intidex, Zara's parent company, has since promised to reimburse its subcontractors' workers as soon as possible. The skyrocketing value of the UK fashion industry has jumped more quickly than our appetite for food. We know that our love of fast fashion is terrible for the environment. It was estimated that this spring, Britons would send 235 million pieces of clothing to the landfill. Consumer debt levels are reaching an all-time high, and as retailers are offering more credit options to their young customers, it's scarily easy to spend money we don't have on clothes we don't need. She wonders whether our failure to address the fast fashion problem is because it affects more women than men at every level. It's estimated that of the 750 million garment workers who are employed to make our clothes, 80% are women working in dangerous conditions and not being paid a living wage, if they're being paid at all. Globally, poverty affects women first. More than 70% of the world's poorest people are women. A globally agreed industry-wide minimum wage and safety standards for all workers is imperative. It's important that manufacturers would face serious punitive consequences for failing to meet these standards. Ultimately, the brands must take responsibility for making these changes, but even if consumers can't lead this revolution, we can definitely agitate for it.
And on October 10th, after 30 years of service to the labor union community, United Labor Credit Union moved and opened its first standalone location in Raton, Missouri. The building renovation was all done by union labor. The building now features a convenient drive-up lane, spacious lobby, ample parking, nearby surcharge-free ATM, and added safety features. Tim Vogler, president of the credit union, said, "We don't have just a new address. We have a new sense of pride and ownership from our staff and our members. We've already had many compliments on the new space and are excited about the growth that's sure to follow." The United Labor Credit Union office is located at 10,000 East 66th Terrace, just 2 miles east of its former space and two blocks south of 63rd Street facing Raytown Road. The phone number and hours of operation have not changed. Vogler said, "This new office location would not be possible without the encouragement of the credit union's members and union locals, the foundation on which the credit union was built and thrives. To show their appreciation, the credit union's board, volunteers, and staff presented Vogler with a President's Award during a reception continuing its concluding its first week of operation in the new location. Vogler naturally spearheaded the credit union's move and the new building's transformation over the course of several months. The credit union will host a grand opening early in 2018. For more information, consult their webpage at unitedlaborcu.org, and they are a nonprofit. That's the news from our side. The news was read by Michael Savoir, Lon Swearingen, Jen Zaman, and I'm Judy Ansel. And stay tuned for War on the Workers by Ann Feeney.
Listen up. We've got a war zone here today, right in our heartland. And across the USA, these multinational bastards don't use tanks and guns, it's true. But they've declared a war on us. Fight back, it's up to you. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time we started calling the shots.
Early next year, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear a case which aims at death by bankruptcy for our public sector unions. Last year, 7.1 million public sector workers belonged to unions. They unionized at a rate five times as high as workers in the private sector. The case which the court will hear is called Janus versus AFSCME. Tonight, we'll devote the entire show to it, first by talking to a legal scholar who will help us understand the law and the constitutional questions raised by Janus, then with a union leader who will discuss the potential impact if the court rules against unions and what unions like the National Education Association, the American Federation of Teachers, SEIU, and AFSCME are doing to prepare. The defendant in the case is AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. I'm Judy Ansel, and our first guest is Garrett Epps. I asked him to be on the show after I read an article he wrote in The Atlantic, where he is a contributing editor. The article is called, Will the Supreme Court Unravel Public Employee Unions? It appeared in October. Epps is a constitutional law professor at the University of Baltimore. His latest book is American Justice 2014, Nine Clashing Visions on the Supreme Court. Welcome to the show, Garrett.
Good to be here.
And you're in St. Louis, pretty close, but not close enough.
No, couldn't get any further.
Okay. Let's first help everyone get clear on what the issue is. The Janus case would bring what's commonly misnamed as right to work in the private sector to millions of members of public sector unions. What does that mean?
Well, under federal law as it is now, states may decide for themselves how they want to order their labor relations with public employees. So some states don't allow collective bargaining by public employees. Other states allow public employees to form unions, but they can't become what's called the exclusive representative of a unit. And then in other states, the union, if it's supported by a majority of the workers in a given unit, will become what's called the exclusive representative of the workers, and it is then supported by member dues and by payments from workers who choose not to join it, because no one can be forced to join a union. That's a basic First Amendment principle. They pay fees for the service that they receive from the union, things like running grievance programs, training programs, you know, counseling to deal with pension problems and so forth, and, of course, bargaining with the state employer for benefits and wages. And that fee is determined by cutting off all the political or so-called chargeable expenses from the dues and then charging that lesser amount to people who've refused to join the union. So this case, as in a number of cases over the past few years, is a sort of very intensely political challenge to that agency fee setup, intending to deprive states of the ability to designate unions as exclusive representatives and permit them to charge the fee, which obviously will reduce the amount of money flowing into these union locals.
That's a really clear explanation. Thank you. And these fees are sometimes called agency shop fees, and they're sometimes called fair share fees.
Fair share fees.
Yeah, and about half of the states have them, right?
That's right.
Okay. So you characterized what is probably going to be the result of the Janus case, which is that the unions will lose, as an assault on public sector unions. Why characterize it that way?
Well, I think there's a history here that goes back 5 years, because from a period from 1977 until 2012, which is a 25-year period, the law of public sector unions was relatively stable. Under statutes as reviewed by the Supreme Court, the agency shop agreements were permitted if states chose to employ that method of dealing with their employees. It had been challenged in the 70s by people who said it violated their First Amendment right to have to pay money to a union to bargain with the state in their, you know, on their behalf. And the Supreme Court had held in a case called Abood in 1977 involving the Detroit Teachers Union that, in fact, it would subvert the entire scheme of labor relations set up by Congress if people could insist on receiving the services of the union but not pay for those services. That was called the free rider problem. And mm-hmm. they said this is a perfectly reasonable way to resolve that problem so that states may use their chosen method of relating to their workers and make sure the unions are not undermined by financial need, you know, to represent people who won't pay for the service. Now, go forward to 25 years, 2012. We come to a case called Knox versus the Service Employees Union. It was a very ordinary case coming before the Supreme Court by some employees who said that certain expenses charged to them by a union in California were not chargeable. They said, these are really political expenses. We shouldn't have to pay them. There have been a lot of cases like that. And the court heard it as a fairly ordinary case. You know, what side of the line do these cases fall on? But out of the blue, without any warning, without any notice to the parties or anything else, in an opinion by Justice Alito, five justices of the court said, you know, we think Abood was really a bad decision and really ought to be overturned because, frankly, we think public employee unions do violate the First Amendment and ought to be taken down. And this is a signal, right, to to people out there, particularly the National Right to Work Foundation and other advocacy groups, bring us some cases. And so they immediately began to file these cases saying that labor unions, public employee labor union fees, violated the First Amendment. And the first one that came up was a case called Harris versus Quinn in 2014, where they challenged the application of the agency fee arrangement to a group of home health workers employed by the state of Illinois. And the court said you can't charge those employees the fees, but they didn't strike down the entire system. They said, we would really like to, this is again an opinion by Justice Alito, you know, we'd really like to, but this case isn't exactly the right opportunity because these employees are not sort of full-fledged state employees. And then, lo and behold, 2 years later, a case comes to the court called Friedrichs versus California Teachers Union, exactly the same claim. The case was argued in front of the court in, I think, in late 2015. And then while it was being considered, and it was, you know, I considered, most people who watched the court considered that it was, you know, a foregone conclusion that the court was going to void the agency fee. But while it was pending, Justice Scalia died. So without his vote, the case was 4-4, which meant that it was affirmed. The lower court opinion was affirmed, and there was no opinion, nothing. And so the whole case had to start over again. Now, we had this interregnum while the Senate Republicans held Justice Scalia's seat on the court open so that their president could appoint his replacement rather than the actual president at that time, Barack Obama. And the result is we now have Justice Gorsuch in that position formerly held by Justice Scalia, and I don't really think there's very much doubt which way Justice Gorsuch will vote in this. He doesn't really particularly care for precedent, and he doesn't he's not a big workers' rights guy either. So this case is now finally going to close the deal that Justice Alito has been trying to push through the court since 2012.
We've been talking to Garrett Epps, who has a really interesting article in The Atlantic in October on this issue of the Janus case. Thank you for that history. It makes it a little more understandable. We'll get to more of the legal issues in a minute, but first I want to give the point of view of the plaintiff. His name is Mark Janus, and he's a child support specialist at the Illinois Department of Health Care and Family Services. He wrote in the Chicago Tribune back in 2016 in an op-ed that he is forced to pay fees to the union that represents him, which is AFSCME. When I was hired, he said, by the state of Illinois, no one asked if I wanted a union to represent me. I don't see my union working totally for the good of Illinois government. For years, it supported candidates who put Illinois into its current budget and pension crisis. Government unions have pushed for government spending that made the state's fiscal situation worse. The union voice is not my voice. The union's fight is not my fight. But a piece of my paycheck every week still goes to the union, and I shouldn't be forced to pay money to a union if I don't think it does a good job representing my interests. What's wrong with this argument?
Well, there's a couple of things, and let's start with the very beginning, because Mark Janus, bless his heart, was not actually the original plaintiff in this lawsuit, and I think if you see the history of that, you'll understand a little bit of how political this is. The original plaintiff in this lawsuit was the governor of Illinois, Bruce Rauner, a sort of millionaire entrepreneur who became governor, and announced that he was no longer going to collect the fair share fee because he didn't think that unions of this sort and these fees were legal. Now, he had no, there had been no court ruling that would allow him to do that, and he was told he had to keep doing it, but he brought a lawsuit in federal court saying labor unions violate, these public employee fees violate the First Amendment. And the federal court said, well, you know, you have no dog in this fight. This is not, you know, they're not collecting the fees from you, Governor. So they dismissed him, and they promptly produced these three other plaintiffs, including Mr. Janus, to be the plaintiffs in this highly political lawsuit. Now, there's a couple of problems with Mr. Janus's argument. I mean, nobody disputes that he doesn't like the union. There is certainly no rule, and this was made at oral argument by Justice Breyer, there was certainly no rule that everything government requires you to do as an employee has to be something that you like or you approve of. And what he is saying is the very core of this case. What the union says is, look, we are here to represent your interests in the workplace. We are here to run a grievance program. If you are, you know, feeling you are being retaliated against or treated poorly or discriminated against in your work unit, come to us. We will file a grievance. We will represent you. We have a procedure. You don't have to go out and get a private lawyer. We run training programs. We help people with the health care programs. We negotiate for better health care and so forth. That's the service we want you to pay for. The political things you are complaining about, that we support candidate X and you favor candidate Y, those things are all already not chargeable to you. Those are the expenses that do not come out of your fees. So you're paying less than our members actually pay because they are willing to pay for our political expenses. So we are not asking you to fund political activity. We are asking you to pay for a valuable service. And, you know, you may not entirely like the way that it is provided in a given instance, but why don't you come and complain to us and we can try to work it out. That's the union's argument. Now, the counter-argument that comes from Mr. Janus and Governor Rauner and the National Right to Work Foundation and so forth is, that there is no such thing as just service, fee for service. Everything public employees do is political, and therefore, if public employee unions bargain for better wages, they're actually engaging in politics, because you know, money spent for public employee wages will not be spent for some other purpose. It's a huge expansion of the concept of what is First Amendment political activity. There was a moment at oral argument in Friedrichs where Justice Sotomayor asked the lawyer for the challengers. She said, the things that the union does with this money, she said, are things like fire safety training. And without missing a beat, this lawyer said, I know, Your Honor, can you imagine anything that goes more deeply to the heart of the political process that's more controversial? And this is utterly with a straight face. Huh. So the First Amendment is kind of like hot jelly on a kitchen table. You know, it just keeps spreading and spreading and spreading into new areas. And as Justice Breyer pointed out in oral argument, the idea that you have to pay for service has never been particularly considered to be a speech-related doctrine. It's always sort of been the way business is done. And some of the services that you pay for are accomplished by speech, bargaining, representing grievances, and so forth. But that doesn't convert them into First Amendment politics. So the court will have to decide. I think the smart money is that it'll be a 5-4 decision holding that public employee unions cannot collect these fair share fees, even if they're exclusive representatives. And the National Right to Work Foundation has already told the court that once they get that ruling, they're going to come back with another case challenging the whole idea of the exclusive representative. And I think eventually, you know, they're going to go after unions in the private sector, too, on this new First Amendment argument.
Unbelievable. Well, that's pretty scary for those of us who support unions. You argue in your article that this isn't just a First Amendment case. And maybe you can clarify this argument. You argue, sort of on the basis of the Abood decision, that the fact that unions provide a public service,
yep,
and bring labor peace, mm-hmm, by negotiating and settling grievances, etc., that outweighs any First Amendment claims. Is that what you're arguing?
Yeah, basically. I think there's a couple of items from labor history that sort of are missing from America's collective memory these days. And the first one was that, you know, at the time of the New Deal and after, there was a decision made by Congress with a very comprehensive system of laws that said we, as a country, the federal government, and favors collective bargaining. We believe that workers, public and private, have a right to act collectively in their own interest, you know, subject to legal restrictions. Now, most of that was private union activity in the 30s and 40s. But what happened as we got into the 50s and 60s, as you know, there was an explosion in the number of people employed by state and local governments, because government began to provide more services, school systems expanded, university systems, hospitals, public health, and so forth. And then there was a wave of strikes. Either unions were formed and tried to bargain, and they would reach an impasse with the local employer, very often a school district, and then go out on strike, or there would be wildcat strikes because the public employer wouldn't recognize the employee's right to form a union, and they'd go on strike to ask for representation. So the decision was made that the way to keep these strikes from happening was to allow public employee unions to form and bargain directly with the states, and we've had many fewer public employee strikes ever since. So that's the labor peace rationale.
So, so one last really quick question.
Yeah.
Isn't this really an issue that Congress or the state legislature should be deciding, not the courts?
Absolutely. It's a political issue that not only can be decided by the legislatures, it's going on now, right? We've had, ever since 2010, this has been an issue in state legislatures all over the country where states make their individual decisions. So there's a federalism part of this, too. And, of course, the conservative wing of the court is very, very strong on states and federalism when it suits their purposes. But suddenly, states can't be allowed to resolve this. this particular issue.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Professor Epps. We're out of time for this segment, but our next segment, Jake White, will be talking to Steve Smith from the California Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO, to find out how unions are preparing if they lose the Janus case. Thanks again very much.
I enjoyed it.
Did you know underwriting KKFI's programming spreads the word about your organization or event and supports KKFI at the same time? Learn more at kkfi.org/underwriting.
This week on The Bioneers.
We need to develop these communities that turn pain to power and turn pain to planting. I don't think you can heal from trauma alone. It is community that heals.
I'm Neil Harvey. This week we go from pain to power with feminist playwright Eve Ensler and permaculturalist Brock Dolman on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Friday morning at 9:30, right after Between the Lines.
Juan Gonzalez.
By the 1970s, neoliberalism supplanted the old conservative strategies. No longer could government simply bulldoze entire communities with what civil rights leaders dubbed Negro or Hispanic removal.
Hear what else he had to say on his recent Kansas City visit on the Thursday night special at 7 p.m.
Even with the price of crude oil low, there are still companies investing in and working the vast bitumen mines in Alberta. On the next Wings, activists from Canada and Texas speak. Wings, Saturday, 2:30.
Are you feeling taxed enough already? So am I, and here's what I propose. Make them private schools and private libraries, private firemen, each with the private hose. Call a private cop when you're in danger. Drive on private roads if they exist. Let's make it one for one and not for many. You're taxed enough already, I insist. This sidewalk where I stand was built by socialists. Communists installed each traffic light. That street sign near your house, evil unions. I tell you, friends, it really isn't right. A man has got to be an individual. That's why you should follow every word I say. Let's make it one for one and none for many. Let's take United out of USA. Look what they're trying to do to health care. It's just my pre-existing condition. And while we're at it, what about your water? Wouldn't you prefer to dig a well? Do it on your own as God intended. Those public pipes will drain you straight to hell. Who needs all these lights and all those wires? I say, don't tread on me. Let's make it one for one and none for many. You'll build the fire, I'll bring the bags of tea. Let's make it one for one and none for many. You're taxed enough already, just like me. Let's make it one for one and none for many. In the land where only markets should be free. Schools and roads and health.
Welcome to Heartland Labor Forum. This is Jacob White. Joining us today is Steve Smith. He is the Communications Director at the California Labor Federation. Steve, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Before we talk about the specific case, could you tell us a bit about the different things that unionized public employees in California do? What are some of the biggest public employee unions, and who do they represent?
Yeah, we represent all kinds of public sector workers, from teachers to firefighters to sanitation workers and many, many others. Pretty much every part of the public sector in California is represented by union members.
So today we are going to discuss this upcoming Supreme Court case, Janus versus AFSCME. I don't think many of our listeners have heard of Mark Janus before. He, just so people know, he's a child support specialist in Illinois, and he's suing AFSCME Council 31. Of course, people's names usually only get famous after they have a Supreme Court case named after them, but who are the real players on the Janus side of the case? Who's pushing this up to the Supreme Court?
Well, this really has nothing to do with public sector workers or even Mark Janus. This is really all about a well-funded network of conservatives, most of whom are millionaires and billionaires, including the likes of the Koch brothers and others, who see this case as an opportunity to silence the voice of public sector workers and to further weaken unions so that corporations have even more power than they have today. This case would be disastrous, not just for union workers, but for all workers and for our nation's middle class.
Impact would go beyond state public employees. Could you expand a little bit on that? Who else would be impacted, and maybe a little bit of specifics?
Well, remember, unions that represent public sector workers fight for things like smaller class sizes for our kids, more funding for public safety. This impacts all of our communities when unions are weakened and workers don't have the opportunity to stand together and have a voice to counterbalance the enormous power that politicians and big corporations and their CEOs wield. Weakening unions only results in lowering standards for all workers. So whether you're in a union or not, this case has ramifications that go far beyond simply public sector workers.
Could you tell us a little more about the specifics, though, for how it will directly impact the public sector workers? What's being argued in the case, more or less?
So the plaintiff in the case is arguing that those who are represented by unions should not have to give the union what is called a fair share fee. So in other words, even if you don't belong to a union, the union is obligated to bargain a contract on your behalf that ensures that you have fair wages and decent benefits like retirement and health care, and also includes worker health and safety and a range of other things. Some people don't choose to join the union, which is their legal right to do. The problem is that what this case is arguing is that those folks who choose not to join the union would not have to pay any sort of fee for the union's bargaining on their behalf, which the union is obligated to do by law. So in reality, what this case does is weakens those public sector unions that bargain on behalf of all of its members and all of those who pay that fair share fee.
Earlier you mentioned the Koch brothers and how they, you know, for people who follow them, they know that they spend just enormous sums of money to kind of throw anything at the wall, get anything out there, and then sort of see what sticks. Are there any specific myths that the other side is propagating about this case that you find to be especially egregious? And then how do you suggest that we challenge these myths?
Well, I think the main myth that they're propagating right now is that this case somehow has to do with worker freedom. This has absolutely nothing to do with workers' freedom. This has everything to do with strengthening the power of big corporations that folks like billionaires like the Koch brothers run. This has nothing to do with giving workers more of a say in a workplace. In fact, that's what a union does. If you don't have a union, workers have no say. They're not able to speak up or speak out when the boss does things that are to their detriment. So this is not about workers at all. It's all about the powerful special interests like the Koch brothers trying to even gain more power and take what little workers have left in this economy away from them.
So the context that the case is coming up in is there's 9 members of the Supreme Court. Do you want, there's been a lot of discussion, even at very high levels, such as senators, about potential conflicts of interests and in how the Supreme Court is composed and whether every justice on the Supreme Court is really fit to make a decision in this case. Do you want to give us a little bit of the history of past, billionaire and ultra powerful corporate interests trying to get this passed, and then what's different this time?
Yeah, there was a similar case, Friedrichs v. California Teachers Association, that was heard by the court a year ago, the court ultimately deadlocked 4-4 after Justice Scalia's death. But we saw the same well-heeled, well-funded interests, corporate interests, who were behind the Friedrichs case, funding this Janus case that is currently pending before the court. The difference, of course, is that now we have a ninth justice, Neil Gorsuch. Justice, I might add, who has an extremely cozy relationship with many of these same powerful special interests that are backing the Janus case and the Friedrichs case before it. So this really looks to be a situation in which the deck is stacked yet once again against the average American worker and stacked for the powerful corporate special interests that control so much of our economy already.
Unfortunately, it does seem like Mr. Gorsuch is probably going to cast the deciding vote. How are unions in California, how are unions across the country preparing for life after Janus, and what can we do as advocates for working people to help support unions as they go about this?
Well, we're preparing as we always do for major challenges. One word to summarize, which is organize. We are organizing at the grassroots level right now within our unions to ensure that every single member of the union understands fully the benefits that the union brings to them, to their families, to their communities. We of course, always do this kind of work, but certainly that effort has been ramped up in the last year or so as we got word that another case was coming down the pike. What I would encourage your listeners to do is to speak out about the need for working people to have the opportunity to stand together, to bargain with their bosses, the value that that brings to our economy, to our communities, to our family, and to our members. This is a time in which we're seeing more interest in unions and more favorable response to unions than any time in the last 10 to 15 years. because people aren't getting ahead in this economy. People are stuck under the corporate rule that exists today. So now's the time to really speak out about the benefits that, unions bring, not just to our own members, but to all workers. So that's what we would encourage your listeners to do.
All right. We've been talking with Steve Smith. He is the communications director at California Labor Federation. Steve, thank you so much for telling us more about this Janus case and some background and what we can do. And we really appreciate you joining us on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Thank you, Steve. Bye. That was Steve Smith from the California Labor Federation. One of the reasons that I wanted to have on someone from the California Labor Federation is because of a recent article that was posted on labornotes.org, which is a great website. Our director, Judy Ansel, she posts stories on labornotes.org sometimes. Her latest one is about right to work. I recommend everyone go take a look at that. But the labornotes.org article that I had in mind came up on October 27th, 2017. It's by Samantha Winslow, and it's called Bracing for Right to Work, Public Sector Unions Up the Ante. And Steve is from California, and this article from Labor Notes had some really good situations, case studies about things that different unions in California that represent public sector employees are doing to prepare for life after the Janus decision, which people expect to come in by around springtime. We could have a decision. And again, with the newest Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch is going to probably cast the deciding ballot in favor of the Koch brothers and their millionaire and billionaire friends, and you know, do what they can again to try to make life harder for working people in the United States. So here's an example of what a California union is doing. This is AFSCME Local 3299, which represents University of California campus and healthcare employees. And according to Samantha Winslow at Labor Notes, the 22,000 member local is preparing for Janus at the same time that it launches a contract fight. That way, workers are encouraged to not just join the union, but to use it actively to fight management. The union settled its previous contract in 2013 after multiple short strikes and used that momentum to prepare for a predicted loss of agency fee when the Supreme Court heard the Friedrichs case. And Steve talked about that case, too. That was the case that was deadlocked at a 4-4 tie after former Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia passed away during the case. So during that campaign, the local built up member action teams and signed up 4,000 agency fee payers as members. So those were people that before were just paying the agency fee, which is what the Janus case is going to say you don't have to do anymore if you if you're represented. You know, even if your contract is bargained by a public union, public sector union like AFSCME, you don't have to pay the agency fee is going to be what happens with Janus. So they were able to sign up 4,000 agency fee payers as full-fledged members of the union. And they're now signing up existing members on commitment cards. And their goal is to get 90% of existing members to sign these commitment cards. Another example is coming from California's electrical workers, the IBEW Local 1245. This is also from Samantha Winslow's article. They are preparing their 2,500 public sector members, including city and public utility workers, for Janus as if they were joining a union for the first time. Samantha talked to organizer Fred Ross, and Fred said, "In a new drive, you are building leadership. We are rebuilding and expanding leadership." The union, IBEW Local 1245 in California, has launched a card signing campaign aiming to re-sign 100% of their current members. Rather than pile that job on top of Stewart's existing duties, they're reaching out to other respected workers willing to work on union building. The local starts with a small group of volunteers in each workplace who are asked to recruit a representative committee of members and to make a plan to launch a card signing campaign. Volunteers also get education on the issues. In August, they were invited to a public sector-wide meeting to learn about the union difference. What are wages and benefits like for comparable jobs in right-to-work states? People in Missouri are slowly learning about that, but hopefully not for long. What are contracts like? Research shows weaker contracts, lower pay, and fewer job rights, as any of our Missouri anti-right-to-work advocates, right-to-work was wrong for Missouri, as we know, and that's part of it, because of the weaker contracts, lower pay, fewer job rights. And so these are just a couple of the examples that we get from Samantha Winslow at Labor Notes. That article is, once again, Bracing for Right-to-Work, Public Sector Unions Up the Ante. It was published on October 27th, 2017. And that is going to do it for today. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'm Jacob White, and you're tuned in to Heartland Labor Forum.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Good evening, and welcome to Remember Our Struggle. I'm Ariana Eckel. Speaking of myself, I was made to realize long ago that the old trade union was utterly incompetent to deal successfully with the exploiting corporations in this struggle. I was made to see that in craft unionism, the capitalist class have it within their power to keep the workers divided, to use one part of them to conquer and crush another part of them. Indeed, I was made to see that the old form of unionism separates the workers and keeps them helpless at the mercy of their masters. Eugene Victor Debs, by far the best-known U.S. rail union leader, was born in Terre Haute, Indiana on November 5, 1855. Born to French immigrant parents, Debs dropped out of school at age 14 and went to work on the railroad as a shop worker. Shortly thereafter, he became a locomotive fireman. By age 20, he was made secretary of his new local lodge of the Firemen's Union. Then, in 1880, he was named Grand Secretary of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Firemen, BLF, and editor of their magazine. In his capacity as a union leader, Debs worked tirelessly to organize the firemen, but soon came to realize that the other railroad crafts must also be organized in order for the firemen to have any real power. Thus, he then assisted in the organizing of the brakemen, switchmen, carmen, and telegraphers, among other crafts, into their respective craft unions. Appreciating the need for active cooperation between crafts and their unions, he set about to organize a federation of rail workers' unions. Success was achieved in this endeavor as well, until craft jurisdiction and jealousy caused the federation's collapse. Not long thereafter, Debs resigned his position as secretary-treasurer of the BLF despite the mass objection of the firemen rank and file. In 1893, together with other forward-thinking rail union leaders, Debs organized the nation's first industrial union, the American Railway Union, ARU. After years of first-hand experience with the failures of the old craft unionism, Debs was now firmly convinced of the need for this new advanced form of union, the industrial union, where all workers in the industry would be organized as a whole, as opposed to separated under the old outmoded craft union structure. The American Railway Union generated wide interest and support among the rail workers of North America. Within 6 months, the new organization had 150,000 members. Its first contest pitted it against the Great Northern and its powerful president, James J. Hill, the Empire Builder, in the spring of 1894. ARU members from all crafts struck, and the Great Northern was paralyzed. In less than 3 weeks' time, the union emerged victorious, winning nearly all of its demands. The power of industrial unionism had been demonstrated. A few months later, the ARU faced another test as it was pitted against the Pullman Company. In what was to become known as the Great Pullman Strike of 1894, the ARU was defeated by a grand coalition of Pullman, the major rail carriers, the corporate press, and the federal government and troops. The carriers, and corporate America as a whole, were determined to smash the ARU because it presented a formidable opponent, a valuable example of what can be achieved when workers organize along industrial lines. Meantime, the carriers continued to work cooperatively with the weak, divided, and ineffective craft unions. Debs and the other ARU leaders were jailed for violating a federal judge's injunction against the strike, which was later upheld by the Supreme Court. Debs's experience with the ARU and prison further radicalized him. Around the turn of the century, together with other labor and populist political leaders, he founded the Socialist Party of America. Debs went on to become a founding member of the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, or Wobblies, in 1905, an industrial-type union that advocated one big union of all workers of all lands. He also ran for President of the United States 5 times, once receiving nearly 1 million votes as a federal prisoner in the Atlanta Penitentiary. That's around 6% of the vote at the time. On June 16, 1918, after nearly a half century of union and political organizing, now in his 60s, Debs gave a speech in Canton, Ohio, in opposition to World War I. He was arrested under the Espionage Act of 1917. He was convicted, sentenced to serve 10 years in prison, and disenfranchised for life. Once again, the Supreme Court upheld his conviction. He was pardoned and released on Christmas Day, 1921, by President Harding at the age of 65. While his health was broken, his spirit and optimism remained indomitable. He remained an outspoken advocate for the cause of labor and the working class. Debs died in 1926 at the age of 70 in Elmhurst, Illinois. Adapted from the RWU, Railroad Workers United, website. Thank you for listening and have a great evening.
Thanks so much, Ariana. And now we got the HLF calendar for this week. First off, we've got the ACLU Free State Forum featuring Floyd Abrams, who is America's best-known First Amendment lawyer and constitutional law scholar. That is Friday, November 10th from 5 to 10 p.m. at the Doubletree by Hilton in Overland Park at 10100 College Boulevard, Overland Park, Kansas. And the next thing is the Heartland Alliance for Progress. It's called What Went Down in Jeff City and a Path Forward with Jason Holzman and Judy Morgan. That will be Monday, November 13th from 5:30 to 7 o'clock. And that'll be at Californo's in the Saloon, 4124 Pennsylvania, Kansas City, Missouri. And for info, you can contact Sarah Starnes at 816-522-5584 or at starwall, S-T-A-R-W-A-L, at AOL.com. What Now? Kansas Politics in 2018, a mainstream forum. That is Tuesday, November 14th from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at the Sylvester Powell Community Center, 6200 Martway Street in Mission, Kansas. The third Saturday Democratic Breakfast is Saturday, November 18th at the La Islas Marias at 7516 State Avenue in Kansas City, Kansas. And you can RSVP to Scott Mackey at scottmackey08 at yahoo.com. And then we have Friendsgiving for a Clean Dream Act, November 18th, 5 to 8 p.m. at the Village Presbyterian Church, 6641 Mission Road, Prairie Village, Kansas. And lastly, Our Part in White Supremacy. It's Sunday, November 19th at noon at the Shawnee Mission UU Church at 9400 Flum Road in Lenexa. You can check out all of our calendars at the heartlandlaborforum.org. Next week, we will be featuring Thomas Cochin with Shaping the Future of Work and Public Defenders Need a Bailout. I've been your engineer tonight, Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.